Welcome to How Fitting, the podcast for slow fashion designers and entrepreneurs about creating clothing and growing a business that fits your customer lifestyle and values. I'm your host, Allison Haynes. I can't believe it's here. This is episode 100 of the How Fitting podcast. Each of these conversations with fashion designers and business owners has explored how they create clothing and grow a business that fits their customer lifestyle and values. I've enjoyed getting to know each of these people and sharing what drives their decisions, and it has been a privilege to share their stories with you on this podcast over the past 4 years. Fashion has meaning and significance far beyond the superficial look, as I'm sure you know. To celebrate this 100 episode milestone, I asked you, the listeners, which episodes and guests have stood out to you the most. Whether it was because you saw your own story in theirs, picked up a new business idea, or gained the courage to pursue your own values more fully, I want to celebrate the impact these stories have had. Coming up, you'll hear highlights from 5 past episodes and what made them a favorite. Each guest and brand have found their unique fit, but there is so much in each story that we can relate to and learn from. How fitting is that? First, we have a favorite from Miriam Baker of her namesake label, Miriam Baker. She says, "My favorite episode of the How Fitting podcast is Selling Your Products Without Selling Your Soul with Elizabeth Stiles. This episode stands out because it addresses the challenges many entrepreneurs face, maintaining their integrity and values while striving for business success. Elizabeth's insights on how to stay true to your brand's core principles and ethical standards while navigating the competitive landscape of the fashion industry resonate deeply with me. What particularly stands out is her advice on maintaining authenticity in your sales approach. Elizabeth explains that by focusing on the genuine benefits of your products and how they solve your customers' problems, you can create a sales strategy that feels honest and aligned with your principles. This not only avoids the feeling of compromising your soul, but also builds a deeper connection with your audience. Listening to her practical tips and heartfelt insights makes me feel empowered to grow my luxury, fuller bust clothing line in a way that honors my values and strengthens my relationship with my customers. Her guidance is invaluable as I continue to design and offer well-fitting, elegant garments that cater to full-bust women, ensuring they feel both confident and valued." About How Fitting in general, Miriam adds, "Overall, How Fitting has equipped me with the knowledge and confidence to navigate the complexities of the fashion industry while staying true to my principles and delivering high-quality, well-fitting garments to my customers." Miriam, I love to hear it. I'm so glad that this podcast has given you the tenacity to pursue good fit in multiple areas of your business. Now, let's hear some highlights from episode 72 with Elizabeth Stiles.
It's a whole level of psychology that you don't really learn about, and I don't think is talked about enough either. I think people just sort of see product plus social media equals money, and it's not quite as simple as that. There is like this, we're not working as robots, we're working with human beings, and human beings are so complex in their thought process that you need to understand how people buy. It's not your business to worry about what people can and can't afford. You have to set your prices at a level that is profitable and commercial, that is viable to make your business run. But worrying what people can and can't afford is so subjective and also so out of your control that it's just a waste of time worrying about that. You should be focusing on how you can portray why it's priced the way it is and the value that your customer is going to receive through investing that money and making that exchange. So I'd say that's what people worry about needlessly, is like the fact no one's got any money, whether they can afford it and whether they're even interested, because if people are following you, they've given or like signed up to your mailing list or whatever, they've already given you the green light to talk about your stuff. And by you not talking about it, they're just sat there waiting. It's like buying a ticket for the Beyoncé concert and she doesn't come out on stage because she's like, oh, what if nobody's interested? And it's like, well, everyone's bought a ticket to the show. Like, go out on stage and give them something to watch. And it's the exact same. And, you know, if somebody doesn't enjoy the show halfway through, they'll probably just leave and that's fine. But there'll be loads of other people who do carry on. And I think using that same Beyoncé analogy, she doesn't stop singing because she might see one person walking out the back door and ignore the 300,000 other people who are cheering her on. I'd say that's something that small businesses do is like really, really, really focus on the negative, rather than sort of celebrating those wins and celebrating all the people who are there, who are supporting them and celebrating what it is that they're doing.
Is there a difference between marketing and selling? Because the beginning, you talked about the three pillars, marketing, mindset, and manufacturing, but then we've been talking about a lot about selling. So is there a difference between those two? And if so, what is that difference?
Yeah, definitely. I would say marketing is telling people what you do over and over and over again and just being visible to your audience and sharing the story, giving value to your audience and having a conversation with them, I guess. So marketing is probably like the umbrella that sales sits within. And what I see people doing online is a lot of, well, you know, sometimes no marketing, or a lot of marketing, but no selling. And so they'll be talking about what they're eating for lunch, you know, letting people in on their day, getting people to get to know them, talking about their pets, talking about where they live, talking about the fabrics that they've chosen, discussing the fit of how things are going, you know, like here's my first fit sample, here's my second fit sample. And then they just go around again. And I'm like, are you a girl who loves sewing? Or are you a, can I buy any of this stuff that you're talking about? And if you just think of two little birds on a wire sat outside, one's looking in one direction and one's looking the other direction, and one is thinking, God, I really wish I could tell them what my prices were and ask them to buy. And then the other bird is like, God, I really wish they would just give me a link to buy this thing. And it's like you're so close, but so far in making the sale. And if you just every now and then said, this is available to buy. So I would say that's one side of it, but then the other side is people don't really know how to market, and all they do is say, grey t-shirt, £22, available via the link in my bio, and they just sell, 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 and actually they lose their customers' interest altogether. And so it's all about finding a balance between the marketing and the sales because you want to keep their attention, but you also want to make money. So what I suggest is that you put out a marketing style post that is providing value to your audience. And that can be something like a mood board of your brand or your collection. And then perhaps you talk about how to measure yourself if all of your products are made to order. And then you put out a post that is like, everything about me behind the scenes, and then you ask somebody to buy, that makes sense. And then you go round again and you go value, 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 sell, value, 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 sell, and you go round in a loop like that.
If you want to learn how to show up online and sell without feeling sleazy, the full episode 72 with Elizabeth is worth a listen. The link is in the show notes. Niraj sent me a lovely voice note about his favorite episode.
My favorite episode has been prioritizing customer research and values to shape a modest activewear brand with Asia Cohen of Transcendent Active, which you recorded on March 26th. Asia helped me find a wonderful dress for my wife, and thank you very much for your questions and for having her on your podcast. Really enlightened us as to how a business goes about not only making money, but prioritizing its customer values, inclusivity, for example, which really speaks to a great business model. So thank you very much for having her episode, and thank you as well.
Isn't that just the best feeling when a brand treats you like a friend whose opinion matters instead of a dollar sign that needs to be captured? This is the superpower of small businesses for sure. Let's hear from Asia herself about how she's putting her customers and values first in her business, Transcendent Active.
And even, now, every time I tell people that I make in America, they all say, the first thing they say is, "Oh, so do you make in China?" I'm like, "No, I make it in Los Angeles." And everyone's shocked. It's like kind of crazy that people are so shocked. Yeah, I think that, people, especially with the rising costs of everything, and it's just hard to live, and I get that. But I think that people are not still afraid to spend money. I think they're hopefully, and in my opinion, I think they're wiser about how they spend their money. Of like, okay, everything right now is kind of up, but I'm going to give it to the person where I really care about what they're doing or where that money is going, not just like, okay, I'm going to just give it to Amazon again. So I do think that for as much as people want, mass produced things, I do really think that they believe in small businesses and in the value of relationships when they're buying products. Hopefully. I hope.
I mean, your brand's been around for 3.5 years, and it sounds like you've very much grown your collection, and I'm assuming that's a
I
testament
hope.
to
I
that
think
people do agree with that.
I think people agree. Yeah, I do. I think people agree. So it's real, you want to build the relationships. Like sometimes, I have my corporate brain on a lot of the times, and I do have to like step back from that sometimes. But you're so conditioned, like, because I was trained in that way of to be, okay, wait a minute, I'm a small brand. Okay, this is what I want. I'm small. I'm not Ralph Lauren yet. Like, we'll get there. You kind of have to think like people are here. You want to talk to your customer. As much as I put out a like an Instagram post or I put out an email, that'll get people's attention. But really, when maybe they ask you a question in an email, oh, what size? Or they send you a DM and they say, hey, what would look good on me? It's like personal shopping. They want to know, like, oh, I can come to Asia and like she'll help me out. Kind of, I guess, what your question is about how do you know what to do? I was thinking about it from a design perspective, because I just had a call on Friday with my friend who's the president of like a very big brand, and we went over my line sheets, and she's like, and she's great, like she's worked at huge brands, and what I think, I'm like, okay, I think we need to do this tee, and she's like, everybody does a tee. Why? What's your so great about your tee? I'm like, well, my tee is great, but I don't know. Like, what else is great about my tee? She's like, do why is she said, what are your best sellers? And I'm like, oh, my all day active skirt, my knot dress. That was the second thing I said. And she's like, well, I don't see that on your line sheet. Why is that not on your line sheet? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I just thought because we introduced a new dress, we don't really need that dress right now. And she's like, Asia, you're telling me that that's one of your best sellers. Who cares if you just introduced another dress? That's your opinion. Like, your customers don't care about your opinion. They care about what they want. I'm like, oh, okay. She's like, put that back on the line sheet right now. I'm like, okay, never mind. I'm like, but it's in black and it's spring. And she's like, it's black. Everybody buys black. Just put it in black. I'm like, okay, fine. Like, you get also kind of caught up. And then you think, oh, I have to introduce something new. And she's like, no, this is amazing. This is what they want. Bring it into this, bring it back, have it in black, have it in another color. Don't let go of it. I'm like,
Yeah.
okay.
Don't reinvent the wheel in
Yeah,
this.
I mean, it's crazy. I'm like, well, they want a skirt with a pocket. And she's like, okay, well, what's the best skirt you have? I'm like, it's this new skirt. Okay, add a pocket. Stop thinking so hard about it. Do that and move on. Like, I'm like, oh, okay, fine. Great. What makes it unique is that it's catering to a modest customer. And when I started exploring what modest activewear, what was on like the modest activewear scene, everything is attached leggings and skirts. And it was not in fabrics that I thought were buttery soft and beautiful and what I would want to put on my skin. It didn't have the fit that I thought it should have. I needed it to be, a more contemporary fit, and it didn't feel like true active wear. It felt like the leggings didn't feel like those were like Nike grade leggings. They were leggings. Okay, fine. They're leggings, and the skirt was fine. It's a skirt, but it didn't have that like performance feature where it had a step up. So I felt like that was missing. And in the beginning, I really did think that a skirt with attached leggings was probably the best bet. I'm like, oh, it's a modest activewear brand. That's a good idea. And then when I started my Instagram without a product, I just started talking to to people who I didn't even know because I did not know one thing about modest activewear. I had no idea. I just thought, well, I didn't think actually. My friend who we used to work in design together, and when I lost my job, my last corporate job, she had switched from design to career counseling, and she said, "You have to design something that serves your community." And I thought, "Who is my community?" And then I realized, "Oh, well, I am Jewish. I live in an observant neighborhood, and everybody in my neighborhood is wearing long skirts to go walk in, to go work out in, and they're long and they're heavy, and the fabric doesn't do the things that it should be doing, and they don't look like official kind of like runners or walkers or worker outers. Like they're just wearing this to serve a purpose, but like, yes, I understand that you have to wear something to serve a purpose, but also what you're wearing should also serve a purpose." So I thought, well, I design activewear. I'm going to design this modest activewear. And that's kind of really how it all came to be. So, in the beginning, when I was just like getting to know potential followers and customers and people online, they said that they didn't like skirts with leggings attached. And I was kind of shocked. And they were like, well, no, I like my leggings a certain way. And like leggings are like jeans, like you have your love with your leggings. Like, and I do sell leggings. And sometimes, maybe I wear a size, someone could wear a size medium in a legging and a large in a skirt. It's not always the same size. And you don't wash things the same way. Okay, so my customers, I don't know. They weren't my customers yet, but they were my friends online. And they said, we don't want it attached. And then I started thinking, I'm like, wait a minute. This makes way more sense. First of all, it's going to be much more cost effective for me to make two separate pieces. And it goes with my whole sustainable ethos because you're going to wash certain garments less and you're going to be able to mix and match. And if you're just wearing that one thing, you're not really mixing and matching. You're just tied to that one thing. So, like, say it's in a color that you're not into that color anymore, then you're kind of done with that. Or, it can't be like worn in a different way. And really, transcendent is all about wearing the pieces in your collection with everything else that you own and being able to dress it up to go out and work out in it, to dress it up to go to work, to go out for dinner. It's not just it's not an active wear only. It's athleisure, it's lifestyle. Like I'm running out in it, I'm running errands, I'm going literally running in it, and then I'm running out to a date. So like it's all in the same pieces. So I thought that just sounded like a much more of a sustainable win. And it kind of came to be of like, it all started from like listening to a customer, listening to people. I'm like, oh, okay, that's what we're gonna do.
Corporate fashion has ingrained in us one way of thinking, but when you run your own business, you have the freedom to create a different kind of business. A business that is more personable, more aligned with your customers' values, and more supportive of your lifestyle. That's what Asia and so many of you listening have chosen to do. Jacqueline Schumann of Jacqueline Diane shared that listening to how fitting has affected me in a positive way, as I'm able to digest information during the times I'm not at my computer. It's so helpful to hear advice, others' experiences, and be mentally in even when I'm out and about. As for her favorite episode, she writes, "Episode 92 with Laura Briggs in the shortlist is my favorite so far because it reminded me that everyone has to start somewhere." The fact that Laura started a fashion brand with no industry experience and has been able to keep it afloat is admirable and inspiring. This reminded me that even though many times I feel not qualified enough, I just need to keep trekking and putting myself out there. Smiley face. That's so true, Jacqueline. We all start somewhere and learn as we go. It can take months or years to see the fruits of that effort, but it is so rewarding when we do. Keep it up. Originally, Laura was actually on episode 37 of How Fitting, where she talked about first starting the shortlist.
So my name's Laura, and I started The Shortlist, which is a petite fashion brand that launched last year. And I suppose the most interesting thing about me is that I did it with absolutely no background in fashion or anything to do with clothing manufacture. So my journey's all been about how I've sort of got where I am and how I'm going to get the brand to success without having done this before. So I did everything. I basically, when my fiance said to me, "I think you should start a fashion brand," and I went away and researched it, I didn't have the first clue. I didn't even know how clothing was made. It was that much of a, I was really sort of working from nothing. So the way I went around it was by writing down a list of everything that I'd have to do. And throughout my research, I'd find more and more steps. And I put together sort of a Gantt chart in Excel of everything I'd have to do in order and sort of the weeks that it would take to do each one, sort of working all the way up to a launch. And I just tackled them one by one. And every time I'd find something new, I'd add it in. But it's just, everything from setting up the company and, the company accounts and all the sort of administrative side of things to finding a designer, finding someone I was going to manufacture with, finding out how the manufacturing process worked. All of that stuff I did alongside my recruitment work for about 7 months before quitting officially and sort of launching my Instagram account and going, if you like, inverted commas, live with the business. So yeah, I had to get all of that stuff figured out before I could even start making the business feel official to the public. It's so rewarding, to look back and say, I did all of that stuff myself rather than I went to somebody who's done it for themselves and asked them if they can tell me how they did it. I just think if you want to set up a business, this is the sort of thing that you've got to thrive on because I often find this even now, there are so many things that I come to that I have no experience in, and I don't have a business partner. I don't have anybody else who, for whom this is their job, it's all on you. And I think if you don't like doing that, then you have to question whether starting a business is right for you because you do sometimes just have to get your hands dirty and figure it out for yourself.
how is your fashion entrepreneurship maybe different than you expected it to be at the beginning?
It's just so much harder. I mean, I definitely didn't sign up for this. I didn't for, you know, it to be a quick win or, you know, to make, you know, to get rich quick, any of that stuff. But it's so much harder than I thought it would be. It's the problems are so big and they're often so frightening. And you really are, you know, well, in my case, I really am doing this on my own and I don't have anyone around me who necessarily knows the answers. It is really sort of figuring things out as you go along. And I just, I look back and I just think it's been so difficult, but I think the shortlist is going to be really successful. You know, there's so much that's been fabulous about it. And although it's been very difficult for me, I think that it's all part of the journey and it is just making it so rewarding. I can imagine if, you know, in a couple of years' time, things are like, you know, really taken off, that I'll look back and all of this period will make that so feel so much better, if you see what I mean.
Two years later, I had Laura back on the podcast in episode 92, Jacqueline's favorite, to share how the shortlist had grown and how she had grown as an entrepreneur as well.
I think that you accept that part of the early stages of running a fashion brand is going to be working out, you know, all the little bits that fit together and, you know, losing money at the start. But as long as you're seeing that progress and you're seeing each little incremental thing that takes you in the right direction. And now I'm seeing all of that come together and I've got, you know, my collections draw net profit now and I'm able to start thinking about the next stages of scaling. So it's all been worth it, but it's just been sort of consistent head down hard work. It's not been any like massive eureka moments. It's pretty unsexy stuff, but it's got me where I am now. I think that it's like broad spectrum that I'm not making for myself personally. So I can think about the way that I shop and the kind of pieces that I want to wear. But when it comes down to things like colour, for example, it's not my personal taste that I have to think about. And I, every season, do check in with things like polls and I'll have my own ideas of what I think. And then I kind of get a, you know, a bigger picture idea of what everybody else would like. But more often than not, it comes down to my gut feeling. And I think I've just done enough collections now to know when it's worth taking a risk and when you want to do something quite safe. But for the most part, I seem to have been getting my decisions right. So perhaps that's why I'm trusting myself more now.
What are some of the things in the business that like you love the most that you never see yourself giving up? It seems like you really enjoy kind of the business side and the operations and... yeah, what are those things?
Yeah, so I love the business stuff. I love numbers. I love spreadsheets. And I also love the marketing side of things. So managing my Instagram, I love writing emails and I put loads of effort into making sure that those are things that people want to open. And copywriting is really good fun. The tone of voice of the brand is all my work. And it feels a little bit like a creative side to balance all the business stuff. And all of that is just in my comfort zone. And I think things like design and production management are all things that I've had to learn, and I can see somebody who would be better at doing those eventually, and it'd be nice to hand those over. But I don't know, it's nice, the idea of as the business grows and you take on people who are really good at what they do to then still be, you know, overseeing it and learning more about the way they do those things. I feel I'm interested in all areas of business, but don't want to be the one hands on the ground like for all of it. But they've been lovely, my customers. And I think because I'm so open about what's going wrong and what I'm doing about it, they've just seen somebody who's figuring things out as they go. See what I mean?
Yeah, that's great that everyone has been like really supportive, even if there was hiccups and things. Yeah. So with each of the, like at what collection did your business kind of like start to turn a profit on the collection. So I know now you said you're getting some profit and you're kind of investing that wisely in different areas, buying more stock. But how many collections did it take to get to that point where you were profitable?
This is such a good question. So I launched in June 2021 and I launched 3 collections in that 6-month period to the end of that year. And all of those lost money. The next year, I did 2 collections in 2022. Both of those collections made gross profit. So they paid for themselves, but they didn't cover business costs. And then last year, SS23, so my spring summer last year, broke even. So it paid for the business running costs and itself, but didn't make any leftover. And then the collection that I've just done made a decent amount of net profit. So now I'm sort of, that's what I mean. Like now I feel like I've actually got a business rather than an expensive hobby, because it's only going to get better. But it's, you know, it just sounds like you said at the beginning, like it all looks so glamorous, but behind the scenes, it's all of this business stuff and staring at spreadsheets and drilling down on all the numbers. Like that's what gets you there. And it's been really satisfying to see it start paying off.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. And congratulations to get to that point. I'm sure like makes it worth it.
Definitely.
So does this include, like, are you paying yourself a salary, or is this just kind of like overhead running the business admin? It's covering that, but not like covering paying you.
It pays me a very basic director payroll, which is not a livable salary. It's a few hundred pounds each month. And that's all included in my business running costs. But my hope is that next year I can pay myself back all the money that I put in to start the business up. So just to have my savings back. And, you know, as soon as you've got something, because it's all the little things that you put on hold as a business owner that you don't talk about too much on Instagram. But, you know, even the little things, you know, weirdly, I mean, ironically, buying clothes for myself is something that, you know, I don't do much anymore now. And so, but then, you know, it's so rewarding.
Laura is so savvy, yet so humble when it comes to the business side of her brand. The way she has learned from zero, experimented, and figured out what works for her in the shortlist is a beautiful example of what fashion entrepreneurship is like. She is serious about her business, but if you listen to the full episodes with Laura, that's episode 37 and 92, she ends each interview talking about how, at the end of the day, she wants fashion to be fun. Talking about his favorite episode, Giovinco Hernandez wrote, "I would say episode 81 with Junie, because she was 10 years old when she started with her fashion journey." Giovinco started his fashion journey at a similarly young age. He shared part of his story with me. In a small town in Guatemala, he spent his early years fascinated by the rhythmic hum of his older brother's pedal sewing machine. He was just 8 years old when he began to tinker with the fabric scraps they left behind, dreaming of creating something beautiful with his own hands. His brothers, patient and skilled, often showed him the basics. In 2008, at the age of 16, Giovinco immigrated to the United States, seeking a better life in the bustling city of Los Angeles. The journey was fraught with challenges. He arrived in the midst of the Great Recession, and the economic downturn meant opportunities were scarce. His mother found work in one of LA's factories, and Giovinco had little choice but to join her. Despite the grueling work and his limited language skills, Giovinco was determined to succeed. His mother, always a pillar of strength, patiently taught him the nuances of the trade. Slowly but surely, he began to master the machines, stitching together not just fabrics, but the fragments of his new life. Giovinco's journey from the humble beginnings of his family's sewing machine to the bustling factories of LA was not just a story of survival, but one of growth, learning, and the unyielding pursuit of dreams. Now, he is on his way to build his own clothing brand. His goal is to have a slow fashion brand and ethical practices. He plans to one day give other people a better job in the fashion industry, and says that with the help of other people in fashion like Allison, he can achieve his dream. Giovinco, your story is beautiful, and I look forward to seeing you fulfill your dream. I'm so glad to hear that, just like Emily and her brand Junie, you also have supportive family members to look up to and draw inspiration from. Let's listen to a bit of Emily Bracey's story from episode 81 as she tells how her grandmother taught her and inspires her.
Yeah, I always had a love for fashion. And a lot of that actually came from my grandma. Her name's Grandma June. And that's actually who my brand is named after. This past August was actually 10 years since her passing. So it's been this really cool time in my life where, you know, I'm in my early 30s and I lost her in my early 20s. And it's just been really cool to feel like kind of I'm a kid again with all of these memories of fashion. So when I was little, I would have these little, I say, Grandma, can I do a fashion show today? And she like knew what that meant. She had this box of just beautiful gowns and dresses. Her and my papa would just go dancing all the time. And still, I was very lucky to be gifted those dresses when I was about 16 or 17. So I have all of them. And
it's so
it always, yeah, they're so cool. And it's so funny too, because I'm like almost 5'10 and she was like, I think 4'11 when she passed. So it's just so funny how some of the stuff I can barely fit into because she was so itty bitty, but everything that was floor length on her is like knee length for me. But anyway, so something that always stood out to me, even like as a middle schooler, was just like how the clothes were put together, you know, back when they would like only use metal zippers and it just seemed so extra delicate, but at the same time, it also had a better craftsmanship to it. So that's something that really sparked my interest. And from then on, like, you know, my grandma, she taught me the basics of sewing. I would do like hand embroidering with her. She taught me how to knit. Eventually in high school, I started taking sewing classes. I started taking classes in like digital arts as well, because I knew that's where like fashion was heading. And in 2013, I ended up as a student at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City. And as that, I mean, it was such an incredible experience. I mean, who wouldn't want to live in New York City when you're 21 as a fashion major with your best friend, you know? And so I did that. And it was a very bittersweet time for me. That was actually when my grandma passed away. But it also, I learned so much about the fashion world that now I mean, we can openly say it's secret, it's hidden, like how clothes are made, who makes them, what actually is put, like you, like a lot of people like, oh my God, I got this shirt for $5. It was such a good deal. But now to learn what that, like to learn what that meant back then, even to just the treatment of models that I would see at like runway shows and stuff, it was not as if my dreams of being in fashion were shattering. It was more of like, this is not the way I see myself going about it. There's this hustle to the fashion industry where you are a perceived hustle where, you know, everything seems so go, go, go and cutthroat. And to me, I was like, well, why? Like, why does it have to be like that? And then I think a huge eye opener for me was when, and I think I'm saying this right, I believe it was in like Benghazi or Bangladesh when the factory collapsed in like 2013, I believe.
Yeah.
And I was in school for that. Like I was at one of the top fashion schools in America and not one person was talking about it. And I was like, guys, how are we all just like just going on our day? Like this is insane. And just no one said anything about it. And a lot of people were like, oh, so are you like done with fashion? And I'm like, no, it's just, you know, it's going to take its time. It's going to happen when it happens. I know I'm going to do it one day, but I'm going to do it with the morals and like the ethics, honestly, that like my grandma instilled in me. Definitely patience. And, you know, just taking things as like learning moments. Definitely. I had an art teacher who back in high school almost made it seem like, you know, with art, which I consider fashion art, like, you can't really mess up. You learn and then you just do it again.
Yeah.
So that's something I've always taken with me. And I definitely took that with me through the 3 years of designing this dress. I feel like sometimes I have it under control. And then I'm like, usually when things, I don't feel like I'm on a schedule or keeping up, I just need to take a break. I think we forget that, especially as creatives. And like right now I'm like looking at my reflection in the computer and I have a necklace on that my mom gave me and it has a pause sign on it. And I think that's like what keeps me sane is like, you know, not only me like remembering to take breaks and that I'm one person, but like stick to your schedule. Like it's okay. I write down everything, like literally everything, like even text back my brother, like I write it down. Cause like you could put me in front of a sewing machine and 8 hours later, I'll pick my head up and go, where am I? Mm-hmm. It just gets so into it. But I think, yeah, giving myself grace, taking time to pause and for myself. And then I have a really good like support system with my family and my husband. Like he'll be like, listen, you've been sewing for like 10 days straight. We got to leave the house, girl. But yeah, for me, definitely, it's just lists, sticking to them and not letting myself overdo it. Because being a slow fashion brand, you know, our brains are just like so creative, overflowing. But like, it's so fashion. I can't be staying up every night until like 3 a.m. Like that's the opposite of what exactly, ethical labor is supposed to be. And actually, now that I'm saying this, it reminded me of a quote actually that I got from my therapist. And she said, make sure you treat yourself not only as the boss, but also the worker. And that like opened my eyes. Like I would never have someone work for me and be in like sew from 9 a.m. until like midnight. Like that's crazy. So why am I expecting that of myself?
What is something that you are most proud of in this past year running the business or that you're most excited about for the next year?
Oh my gosh. I think I'm most proud of just like, I know I said patience a lot before, but like my patience with it, but also just like sticking with it. And wow, this is a hard question. What I'm most proud of. I think that's it. You know, I think just completing a year is such a big deal. It's yeah, like I literally just the whole thing in general is what I'm so proud of myself. You know, I'm proud of like that 10-year-old girl who just like wouldn't stop drawing dresses and like cutting up things around the house to make clothes for dolls.
Mm-hmm. I did the same thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So our parents knew. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm also just super proud of, I don't know, it's the weird way to say it, but like my grandma and how she's been gone for 10 years and I'm still like learning so much from her. Something I didn't mention was that along with her dresses, I was also given like all of her sewing stuff. And still today, I'll find like these little things. Like a couple months ago, I found like a tiny piece of paper, like probably like folded up to like an inch by an inch, and it just had some thread wrapped around it, and the thread was no longer than maybe 3 feet at most, and like this woman kept that thread to be used for something else. And like I'm looking back at like school where it's like, oh, you only have a couple like yards left on that spool, just throw it out. And I think these little things that I'm finding of hers and stuff, I'm proud that, you know, I'm not just like, oh, this is thread. Like I'm looking into it and I'm like, wow, like this can be something.
It is so important for us as business owners to have people that surround us and support our dreams. Who is that person or those people for you? Is it your family, friends, maybe a mentor or coach, or a circle of other business owners? I hope you have a community around you, whoever it is. I also also wanted to share one of my favorite episodes with you. It's episode 29 with Kimberly Borges and Miriam McDonald of Power Women. This is an older episode, but it stands out to me for several reasons. First, Miriam and Kimberly have such an invigorating perspective on failure that we can all learn from. They have experienced failure, but they don't let that hold themselves or each other back. They know their power and unabashedly step into it while acknowledging that they don't know it all. If you've struggled with fear of failure in your business, this full episode is a must listen. It's also Kimberly and Miriam's partnership dynamic that makes this episode so memorable to me. This is the episode that started my captivation with interviewing co-founders. You get a peek into their partnership and what it's like to run a business with your best friend. Miriam and Kimberly are so fun to listen to in this episode, and it makes me just a little bit jealous that I don't have a co-founder in my business. Today, I'll give you just a taste of my conversation in episode 29 with Miriam and Kimberly.
It's kind of been like learn as you go. Like we always say, we learn everything from Google University.
Yeah.
But I mean, obviously there's things that you learn, you know, growing up. And I mean, we learned our customer service. We learned our sales, like how to sell from car sales like that. You know, being in that industry for 5 years gave us like so many things that without it, I think our business wouldn't be as successful. Because whenever you're in car sales, you're basically like your own business. Mm-hmm. Like you have your own customers and you're like have to be organized and, you know, you have to sell cars, which is the hardest thing to do.
I know, because people walk in negative.
Yeah, with their guards up.
Exactly. And car sales, that's a really aggressive environment. And the company we worked at, their foundation was customer service. It was unlike any other dealership you'll ever encounter. It was an environment in which you were encouraged to gift your customer special, memorable items at the end of the sale. So like if you were selling them a car, right? And they mentioned their like history, you know,
it's their anniversary, their birthday, exactly. They have a grandkid on the way.
You would gift them something that was meant for them and put it in the car, and you create this loyal customer for life. That's actually a book that the owner of the company wrote, Customers for Life. And sales was probably the best education we've ever received in our lives.
Yeah.
Because it put us into a mindset in which we were constantly thinking outside of ourselves. Mm-hmm. So what does a customer want? What do they need? Right. So like where can I serve them best? A customer would walk in and say, I want a convertible, for example, you know, not that we sold convertibles, but just to give you an idea, like I want a coupe car. And they would walk in with their two kids and they'd be like, well, you know, what are you looking to use this car mostly for? And they would say like, you know, taking the kids back and forth from practice. And I'm like, well, you know, let's see if everything will fit in this car or let's look at other options. You know, you kind of want to make sure that the customer is served best. That way they're a customer that will come back, you know, not to return the item, but to buy more. And, you know, we had a lot of return customers because of that. And it was also nice because you were taught to look at the product in a way that was more based on the benefit and not so much on the product itself.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of talking about the car, we would talk about how is this car going to help you and benefit you? Is it going to make it easier for you to drop off the kids, or is it going to make it easier for you to transport your equipment? Is it going to make it easier for you to be in budget during the month because it's in your gas mileage? Like, how is it going to help you? And that has shaped the way we structure our sales and the way we structure our blazers altogether. But another thing that I think subconsciously has helped us a lot is our families, you know, are entrepreneurial. And since we were kids, we've seen our families quite literally hustle. We're both children of immigrants. Miriam is an immigrant. She immigrated here to the U.S. when she was 8. Yeah. And I was born in the U.S., but I went back to Colombia and then came back to the U.S. when I was 7. So my parents are not American. They're Colombian. And so we saw like the hustle from zero, right? Mm-hmm. To create something from zero. It's not like because you're fearless, but in spite of fear, like in the face of fear. And I think that kind of molded our brains to not be as scared of failure and be a little bit more scared of like getting to 90 and being like, oh man, we didn't try that great idea we had, you know?
Yeah. You guys both seem like very like brave in that you're willing to like jump in and like, let's do this. Like we might fail, but that's okay. And we'll learn stuff, yeah. Or it could go really great, but like, I'm not going to stop anything from like, make me try it. So
Miriam is very good at that. She's more of a, like, let's try. And I've actually learned that from her. I've always been I can be an overthinker, but Miriam is much more of like a, let's just pull the trigger. And what I've learned from her is just to like, try it, go as far as you can go without burning yourself. And then like, test it out.
I'm always like, but did you die?
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah. What is realistically the worst thing that could happen? Yeah.
So if we didn't die, we keep going forward. And if we feel death is imminent, then we kind of back up a little bit. Like maybe we don't sell shirts. Maybe we just focus on blazers. Because that's what we did. We went to New York to that trade show. We actually bought, we gave ourselves a limit because we were still so confused. We were like, what do we sell? Right. And so we were like, let's just buy $2,000 worth of product, right? And we walked around, mind you, it's huge. I was like, 6 months pregnant?
Mm-hmm.
And we were,
what show was this?
It was at Javis Center. It wasn't Magic, was it?
I think so.
It was Magic?
No, Magic was in Las Vegas.
Yeah, what was this one?
It was a little one. I don't remember.
Are you sure it wasn't Magic? Was it? I know Magic pops up in Atlanta, Las Vegas. I forgot what it was called. It was related to those though, because all the same brands are there.
Okay.
And you know, we're walking around and we're just kind of testing it out. Like you have to give yourself a budget to fail. And I think because we're so comfortable with, we have failed in our lives. We've, you know, Miriam did HR and she's not an HR person. You know, I did medical school. I'm not a doctor. Like we're just used to pivoting and used to rethinking where we're supposed to be. So failure is not as scary as it for us as it is for other people. So we were like, let's just budget this amount of money and maybe we'll fail. Maybe it'll be a great idea. Who knows? But it's an investment. Mm-hmm. So we bought those clothes and ended up failing.
But we didn't die.
Yeah. And you know what? For our education, $2,000 is worth us learning. You know, I'm worth $2,000 of investment if it means I get to learn.
Yeah, that is a great point to think of it as. You didn't invest $2,000 in a failed project. You invested $2,000 in a learning opportunity.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love how you frame it that way. It's like you're worth the learning opportunity. Even that's worst case scenario, you spent it on a learning opportunity.
As a business owner, you have to humble yourself.
You really do.
You have to know that you don't know everything and you have to be willing to learn. And that's, I think that's why we've been successful, because we knew that we didn't know anything. Mm-hmm. And so we started from zero.
I'm curious how it is running a business with your best friend.
I mean, it's definitely been, I would say, like 95% super fun.
95? Are you kidding me?
We did have one. I'm going to give that
5%. Oh, my. Well, you should give it 10%.
Yeah, I give it 5-10%. But yeah, no, for the most part, I feel like Kim and I are very similar in the way that we like approach business together. Like we're both really good salespeople. We're both go-getters, but we both complement each other like really well. Like Kim is more like, she has to think about things and I'm more impulsive, and Kim's more the creative brain and I'm more like sometimes the business brain. And so we really complement each other and like our weaknesses and our strengths. And so that has really helped a lot. But we also, the biggest thing I think is we also trust each other.
If you could communicate one value or like, you know, a thing you care about to the world through the clothes you design, what would it be?
What I want to communicate the most with women is to, whatever you want to do, do it in spite of fear. Like, don't wait till the fear is gone. Get up and do it. Like, the beautiful thing about our Blazers is that we get to be with you during like your most courageous, exciting, powerful moments. We get to be with you when you get up in front of like a room full of senior executives or people that don't look like you, people who don't think like you, and you're wearing our blazer and you're speaking up for the first time and you're saying exactly what's on your mind, because in that moment you feel powerful, you feel celebrated, and you feel seen. But you don't feel fearless. You're still doing these things in spite of fear. And I think the beautiful thing that I like when I'm packing these blazers and when we're designing these blazers, that's the energy that I'm putting into them, is like that, not fearlessness, but, you know, action in spite of fear. And, mm-hmm. and to do that, that's why to do that, I think you need to be celebrated. You need to be encouraged, or you need to be at least supported. And that's what our blazers do. They support you, they encourage you, and they celebrate you.
So fun.
Yeah. Now Miriam's going to go.
For me, it's kind of similar, but for me, it's more about like, you know, your inner confidence. Like, you know, every woman can be a strong woman. Every woman can be confident. Every woman has great ideas. And so whenever you, I don't want the blazer to like make you confident. Like, you're already confident. You're already yourself. Like, I want the blazer just to kind of like decorate your confidence or who you are as a woman, who is your mom, as a person. And just kind of like bring that, you know, out of you.
I love how you said that, decorate your confidence, where it's not giving it to you, but it's showing it, it's highlighting.
Yeah. It's already there. And you just like, I don't want the blazer to make you confident. Like, it's already there.
Yeah. Like, we don't even like to say empowering women, because I feel like women are already empowered. We just want to make them like feel cute while they're empowered.
Don't you just love the energy with which these women navigate their business, deepen their friendship, and step into their entrepreneurial identity together? If you need a business pep talk or a blazer with pockets, definitely check out episode 29 with Kimberly Borges and Mary McDonald of Power Women. A few additional episodes that received a shout out from listeners as well. The honorable mentions go to episode 77 with Marina Hayes of Peridot Robes. The fierce joy and activism that Marina brings to her business is evident when you listen to her interview or peruse Peridot's social media. Peridot gives people, in this case fat people, the well-fitting clothes they deserve. Their collections are a sellout success. Episode 95 with Madison Powers of Madison Victoria. This conversation with Madison includes so many savvy business tips and relatable stories as she shares how she makes decisions and stays creatively inspired in her brand. Episode 58 with Keddie McKenna of Keddie Vani. Keddie's career journey, her skilled craftsmanship, and generous teaching to a new generation of independent designers are inspiring and definitely worth a listen. Links to all these episodes are in the show notes if you scroll down wherever you are listening. Thank you so much for joining me as we revisit some of your favorite episodes from the first 100 of How Fitting. I hope these stories have helped you create a better fit for your customer, lifestyle, and values in your business. If they have, I hope you'll join me next week as we kick off the next 100 episodes of How Fitting.